Now, everybody's journey through sight loss is unique. Some of us accept the diagnosis and try and prepare ourselves, and others enter a state of denial until such times that it becomes undeniable. Paul Quigley has had an interesting and varied career so far, which includes being involved with a heavy metal rock band and working as a spokesperson on radio and television, done some journalism, but somewhere along the line he had to accept that he was going to lose his sight. And Paul joins me now. Hi, Paul.
Hello there. How are you doing, Simon?
Well, thank you. And it's true, you actually always knew that you were going to lose your sight, and yet you didn't accept it, did you?
That's a good point. I think there's a certain survival instinct in all of us, the sighted and the unsighted, that you don't want to be that Mr. Magoo blind person, no matter what the prognosis of genetics are, which in my family case is a family history of genetic hereditary sight loss. So I knew, because my mother was already registered blind when I was young. So yes, I knew, and yet, quite as you say, I was in denial and didn't want to see, basically, literally envisage myself as that sightless person. And so for many years, as my sight was, I've got RP, which many of us, you know, have in the RNIB know about, retinitis pigmentosa. That was a particular X-linked version I've got. My brother's got it. So genetically, we knew, and we were always very, very highly myopic, myself and my brother. My sisters weren't quite so afflicted. They just carried the gene, the RP gene. So we knew, me and David knew that we were going to go visually, because we could see it in our mother. She ironically, she was highly myopic. So we knew we'd be actually worse than she was, because she was technically a carrier, the female carries the RP gene, and then the male offspring get the full RP, the full blown peripheral tunnel vision, which is what we subsequently got. And I say me and David because, you know, it has been a kind of a joint journey. He went to Oxford, he did very well academically. We went to the same grammar school. I was going to follow that kind of journey as well, but I discovered rock and roll in the 1970s, in my teens, and went the musical route. But yeah, for all of those, just to sort of answer your question, yes, I have been in denial because of all the sort of the self-images that I had of myself and what my future was going to be as a man growing up. I didn't want to be a white cane, dark sunglasses, staggering around. I just thought, no, I don't want that. And so for years I was bumping into things and totally in denial, and literally pushed the envelope to the nth degree, where I just thought, I am going to push this to the point where I'm literally almost going to commit flipping Harry Kiri on myself. And that was only until that point when I just thought, right, okay, hands up, I can't pretend to be normal, air quotes normal, as they said in Parliament, and got into trouble for saying that. Sighted any longer, because I was gradually becoming so severely sight impaired, and I was registered blind by that time anyway in the 90s, that I had to accept that I wasn't this, you know, darting about young man that I wanted to be, but I was this very, you know, having to go in a very sedate fashion because I was sick and tired of banging into street furniture, and I just thought, I don't want to commit suicide and literally, seriously, end up in a wheelchair through banging my knee or shin and becoming immobile. That would have been the ultimate insult to me, but to be not only sightless but also immobile. So I have to be very careful now, and I am consciously careful with my, you know, white stick and my white cane training, that I don't charge about assuming that it's some sort of, you know, lightsaber magic wand that's going to save me from any trucks coming by, or even bicycles. They're worse because they're silent, aren't they? So stepping off a curb with your white stick, you know, you've got to, if you've got any hearing left, and one of my ears is slightly going, because I am 55 now, not 15. So I have to be careful on every, you know, it's all very well being this independent mobile person, but, you know, you put yourself in the line of fire, you're going to get flattened as well. So, I mean, even a dog isn't going to support, you know, stop us for that. So it's all of that stuff. It's all that risk assessment of oneself and one's desire to remain independent, but at the same time realizing that we'll only last 5 minutes if we go charging about like a loony, like some sort of blind Bear Grylls. It ain't going to happen. I ain't going to do it. And yet I still want to be out there, you know, pushing the limits of sight loss and seeing what we can do. So it's a catch 22. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword, that one. And I'm still working on it, obviously, aren't we all? Because we've all got various stages of sight loss. Some have got fully never had it, and others are going to go blind tomorrow from, you know, like diabetes or something. So we're all in the same boat. Nobody is immune to this. And this is what I think I've come to terms with, is that I didn't want to be sightless, but I just thought, well, hell, you know, we're all going to die one day. And it's all about quality of life. Therefore, from this point on, you know, today is the first day of the rest of all of our lives, not just mine, and helping each other and sharing experiences. This is where you and I kind of come into this, because I wanted to share my experience of how it has been for me so far. And it is an ongoing, you know, process. It's not an end result. And because it will get worse, whatever bit, you know, whatever little light patch of sort of vision I still have, which is basically light and shade now rather than anything else. That's what tends to happen with RP. You lose all acuity, goes.
Now, from a man's point of view, and I know for myself, I actually drove for years. I stopped driving in 2004.
Right.
But there were certain things in life that I couldn't do, and I felt quite emasculated by it. And I still do at times, you know. Inadequate is perhaps a better word.
Do I concur with that? To some extent, I do. But then again, I've never really had... Well, I was never able to drive. I've never been able to drive. So I've never had that sort of before and after with driving and being, you know, the boy racer thing. I wish I had. Dreamt of it. But no, I haven't really had... I think what it is more in economics. That there's what they, you know, purchasing power. I used to be able to do a lot of work, you know, because I was able to get out and about. But as my mobility plummeted and I wasn't able to travel, so even though there were things like meet and assist with airplanes and Virgin and trains and all this sort of, I shouldn't advertise them, but I mean, you know, the main sort of rail providers, they do provide sort of meet and assist sort of things going on. I have to say I wasn't able to sort of earn my earning power. There, I think if that was one area I felt emasculated, to use your word, not so much emasculated, but disempowered. That's more how it was. It wasn't really a gender-related thing, because this can apply to anybody. But yes, as a man, possibly. But I mean, I've always been a babe magnet, so I've never had an issue with that. So I don't really, you know, it didn't really affect me in that way. I am winking and sticking my tummy.
Yeah,
very good.
I'm just falling off my chair.
Indeed. So yeah. Okay. Well, it hits you where it hurts. You know what I mean? It's yeah. You have to basically, you take all these things into account, don't you? Really, in terms of.
So
it's all about confidence.
You brought this up though. What about relationships then? Because I think, you know, sight loss impacts the person who's losing the sight, but it equally impacts the possibly the sighted person in the relationship who isn't losing their sight.
Yes, it does. Yes. Well, I was married for a long time, or even I was after the second marriage. And yeah, your partners, they compensate. Well, like they did for me anyway, and they do a lot of the jobs for you that you don't need to do. You know, right, with the reading correspondence, letters, and that sort of thing. They'll do all of that. Well, and online, you know, this sort of thing. They'll do that, and driving around, shopping. That all gets. So yes, it affects them because the burden then falls on them, doesn't it? And they have to be really, you know, in tune with where you are and sympathetic and not sympathetic because they can't be empathetic. The empathy and the compassion, you have to have a good partner. And obviously that, you know, some people don't, or some people have partners and they become bereaved and they become alone. So yeah, you're very lucky. You're very lucky indeed to have somebody who has compassion and empathy. And yeah, I would say that's absolutely vital. And my own story is, yes, I have had compassionate and empathetic people, but it gets to the point where you can't then lean on them so hard, where you become a lazy person. So you have to make sure that you always are trying to do as much as you can, because in respect to them, really, I suppose. You know what I mean? You try and not become a total sort of, you know, a burden on them, and you do what you can, really, Simon. That's the way I view it anyway.
But that's an interesting point. You say burden, because that's the way I think those of us living with sight loss, sometimes we fear that we are going to be a burden on other people's lives, don't we? Especially if we've not had sight loss all our life, and we get it as we get older.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, the thing is about burden, again, you've got a word of a burden. It's like a beast of burden, isn't it? The old biblical reference. But, I mean, if that person genuinely loves you and cares about you, they won't see it like that. And then, even though, so it's, sometimes it's an inbuilt psychological assumption that one's making on oneself, that one is a burden to the other person, whereas in fact they don't see it like that. And sometimes if you say something, oh, you know, so it's always a delicate balancing act, because they don't see it as a burden, because if they care, as I say, they'll do anything to help you and make your life and your quality of life as best they can within what means they have. And so it's this delicate thing that if there is a trade-off between anything that you do, you try and maintain your independence, despite the fact that you've got people that maybe can cook for you, clean for you, shop for you, and whatever, read correspondence. Without tech, obviously, there's technical technology then comes in on some issues. And, of course, that is part of the independence quotient, I suppose, that technology has come to the assistance of partners in that respect, is that we're not so totally dependent on them anymore, which is, we can talk about, you know, later or another time. But technically, burden. Question. It's again, if you find somebody who loves you, then they won't feel that about you. So then that takes the pressure off the sight unsighted person, that they're not a burden, in fact, and that person doesn't see them as like, they're, you know, oh, this is my duty, I've got to do this, but it isn't anything like that. And that can then make the whole dynamic of the relationship literally, you know, positive and back on where it should be if both were sighted people, and their sight wasn't even an issue. So again, it's like the classic thing, every case is individual, every case is different. And my own case, from my own experience, is that my partners thus far have been very compassionate and empathetic. So I don't have any problems with that, but I can imagine that in some relationships it can be very, very, very difficult. And again, it's I don't know what the solution to that is, other than time or just, you know, hopefully compatibility of finding the right person, if that's the way you want to do it. Some people may think, you know what, I'm done with partners, I just want to live alone anyway. Or again, it's every case is different, Simon, I think.
If you'd like to feed into this conversation and make some suggestions on what's been happening, Paul and I would love to hear from you. We're going to be catching up on a fairly regular basis. Paul's got a lot going on in his life, had some big changes recently, and we're going to examine some of the things that you've been doing actually on your own and why you've been doing it over the next few weeks.
Absolutely, that'll be great. I'd love to do that with you, Simon. And some of it is finding, literally, when you move to a new geographic location, it's mapping out where you are in your new universe, like finding your way to the shops, to the toast box, to the, you know, supermarket, that sort of thing, and all that sort of good stuff. And yes, it's like swimming in a great big ocean of uncertainty, and that's where I am right now. Look forward to that.
Paul Quigley, a pleasure. You can talk for England. In fact, you could talk for the universe, I think.
Thank you, Simon. Lovely talking to you too. Thank you.